My name is Chris Bell, and I'm at the home of Lieutenant Colonel John Edmondson, which is out in Gordon Head, just by the university. The date today is June the 6th, 1982. And Colonel Edmondson, let me start by asking you when and where you were born.
Born in Estevan, Saskatchewan, August
17, 1919. 1919. Okay, was your father a soldier at all?
No, he had served in two wars, Boer War and Great War, First World War.
Was he Canadian or British?
English.
Mm-hmm. And did he come to Canada after the Boer or after the First?
He'd been in Canada, I think, on three occasions before he finally settled here.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Canada before the Boer War, sold his farm, paid his way to the UK, joined the forces and served in South Africa.
So he went back in order to serve in the Boer War?
Yes.
Why did he not, there was the option of fighting for Canada at the time.
Well, I think it was perhaps because he was an Englishman himself, and he went back to the Boer War because they had confiscated his claim that they had a gold mine claim in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So he was going back, I guess, to get a bit of vengeance.
And he came to Canada after that war, back?
Not directly.
Yeah.
Not directly. He came back to this country in about 1904, and then was on survey cruise across Canada.
Mm-hmm.
When they surveyed for what was going to be the southern route from BC down through south of Winnipeg, the one that was going to parallel the U.S. border.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on the survey crew that did that route. And all the historic pictures from that, and say, if you can say it's here in the period 1904, 05, or 5 or 6, I can't quite remember,
mm-hmm.
are in the museum in Regina.
Yeah, this was all taking place before Saskatchewan was even a province.
That's right.
I thought so. Okay, he joined up the Canadian forces then in
World War I.
Which regiment did he serve in, or which battalion?
Well, 152nd.
Which eventually became the...
Which is part of the history of the South Saskatchewan as it is today.
Uh-huh. Was he a rank or an officer?
He was an officer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get back to you then. You're born in Estevan. What about your early education?
Oh, public school, high school, same as the usual thing on the prairies in those bad old days.
Bad old days? 20s and 30s.
That's right.
How'd you find that?
At the time as you're growing up, you don't really understand the full impact.
Mm-hmm.
You're aware that there's a shortage of everything, but everybody lived.
Mm-hmm.
We were right on the edge of the Dust Bowl, so we could see the effects of it.
Without being in it.
That's right, and the mere fact that we were the center of a coal mining area helped alleviate some of the problems that those that were strictly farming suffered.
Mm-hmm. After graduating high school, did you go up to university?
Negative. I joined the regular army.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Before we get to that, then, you said you were in the cadets while you were in the...
In my high school years, they had a cadet organization in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it was the rifle team. So we all... It mostly consisted of rifle shooting, which we all joined, and when we became of the tender age of, I guess it was 15, and had sprouted a few inches, we all went down to the local militia, and in our deepest voice, we said, we're 18. So they signed us on. I think one of the first things that ever happened, they put us in the drum and bugle band, and I found myself for about a month being at a big bass drum.
Had you ever played it before?
Never.
Just bang, bang.
That's right.
Mm.
So very quickly, that only lasted a couple of months. We went to our first camp in 1935.
And that was the year you joined up then?
That was the year I joined the militia.
Mm-hmm.
I think by 1936 or 7, I had become a proud Lance Corporal.
Have you now? Reading through the history, it seems as if the South Saskatchewan was in a state of transition about 1935-36.
True. When I joined it, we were wearing the old Saskatchewan Border Regiment. Yeah, Saskatchewan Border Regiment badges.
Mm-hmm.
And there were still relics from the days of when they'd been associated in some distant way with the cavalry, because they still had bandoliers in the armory and things, and people rolled their putties from the knee down rather than from the ankle up type of deal.
Mm-hmm. And so the transition took place in 1936, I think, and you amalgamated with the
Weyburn Regiment.
Mm-hmm. What sort of changes did that?
Not much, really. It just meant we knew we were going to have a change of badge, but we were still wearing the old badges till we went. It just simply meant that people that we had known in Weyburn, we were now all in the same regiment.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. There had been always a bit of rivalry between the two towns, you know, from the sports point of view, baseball, hockey. High school was track and field and basketball and that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But that didn't last. The regiment sort of became one.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any problems becoming one? example, one officer who was commanding the Weyburn became commander of the South Saskatchewan, and the fellow who was in charge of the Saskatchewan Border Regiment was Lieutenant Colonel Supernumerary, if I'm pronouncing that correct?
Yeah. I can't recall the details because I don't know what happened to people, because basically it didn't make much difference to us because we were a company mm-hmm. out of Estevan. So we the Estevan people served together, and all the Weyburn people served together.
So really didn't make any difference from what before, it just meant
no.
that you were a company within...
Within a larger group, and one group happened to come from Weyburn rather than somewhere else, because remember, we had all down the line to Oxbow, Alameda, all through that area.
Mm-hmm.
They all belonged.
Mm-hmm. How did you find militia life in Estevan?
Well, basically, it only comprised training in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
All your training pay in those days was given to the regiment. There was no such thing as they have today, so many days pay a year.
Mm-hmm. But technically there was, but I think it was regimental tradition, was it not, that you gave it back to
the regiment? That's why I didn't make my point clear.
Yeah.
There was pay,
mm-hmm.
but it was the policy within the regiment that no one drew it. We went into regimental funds
mm-hmm.
on behalf of the regiment. And the only pay you drew was your 10 or 12 days at militia camp. That was barely enough sort of to buy a pair of boots that you had. You had to buy your own boots.
Where were the militia camps held, or the ones you attended?
The ones I attended were all in Dundurn.
And where's Dundurn?
South of Saskatoon, about 25 miles.
Estevan?
From Estevan, 350.
And was there rail service? From
we used to go by rail. It meant that we used to get on the train around lunch, just after lunch, and it would be an overnight thing when we'd arrive in Dundurn early in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
Sun up used to be as we went through the valley around Lumsden.
How large was Estevan?
In those days, I would say around 3,500, 4,000 people.
And how many people were in your company from Estevan?
Rough, over 100.
Mm-hmm.
This is just a guess on my part at this time.
Mm-hmm. Well, most of them First World War vets, or were they younger than that?
Oh, no. There were some of the older officer and the RSM, and some of the senior NCOs were World War I, but the majority with whom I served were all young people.
Mm-hmm.
Say under 24 and under.
That's surprising. I've always been under the impression that the 20s and 30s we're talking about now, that the ranks were greatly filled by old vets, but they weren't.
No, and we had quite a number of young officers. The criteria used to be when you graduated from high school and obtained the age of 18, and if you had gone through the ranks and looked suitable, then the most suitable were selected to be trained as officers.
When you say suitable, what sort of qualities were looked for?
Well, I suppose the normal thing, whether you had the right attributes of leadership and had displayed them to become an NCO,
mm-hmm.
Whether you displayed any liking and, you might say, the flexibility to adapt to the military system.
Mm-hmm. Were you singled out for this?
I would have been an officer if I had stayed in the militia
mm-hmm.
After I had attained the age of 18.
Mm-hmm. But you didn't. We'll get to that in a moment. I think a little bit more about the militia. What about weapons and other...
Well, mainly in those days, we had the old Enfield, which they'd used in World War I,
mm-hmm.
and we had the Lewis gun,
mm-hmm.
and we had Vickers, the old Vickers, where we had a section of Vickers in Estevan.
Mm-hmm. What about ammunition? Were you able to fire these Vickers? Because Vickers would go through an awful lot of ammo, I think.
I had never personally fired them. I was never in the Vickers section. They fired, but basically everybody fired a limited number of rounds for annual classification at militia camp.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, I would see around 36 or 7, they built a small rifle range in Estevan,
mm-hmm.
or just to the south of the town. And everyone could go out and fire a few rounds, perhaps 50 in a season.
Mm-hmm. What was your company's designation? Was it?
I can't recall, but I would say B Company.
With B Company. And you were a Lance Corporal at this time during the militia?
Lance Corporal when I left.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and when did you leave?
Oh, I left Estevan in December 1937 and enrolled in the Regular Army in the Patricias in Winnipeg on the 6th of January 1938.
All right, now what motivated you to do this?
At that particular time, I had hoped to go to Royal Military College because finances at home didn't allow one to go. And the vacancy was granted, as you know, in the old days with more political pull than on any other way.
Mm-hmm.
And a chap who I know very well, his father was the kingpin of the reigning government, and he got the vacancy, and I wanted to be a soldier one way or the other. So my father said, I don't recommend that you join as another rank.
Mm-hmm.
He said, because you have no idea what the difference means between being an officer and another rank. He said, however, if you make up your mind, he said, the old saying, once you make your bed, go and lie on it.
So at 18 you went and...
So I joined the regular army at 18.
Mm-hmm.
Years later I found out that there had been a long waiting list. And I often wondered how we managed to get enrolled so quickly. And then on the first time I was home, how my father knew so much about what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
Some months later I found out that the adjutant and my father had been personal friends in World War I.
So a little bit of pulling behind the scenes.
I would imagine so.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. It's just,
that was more the system then than it is today.
Mm-hmm. I think that's how it's come about, yeah. All right, you join up. Where are you sent right away? Are you sent to the Patricias?
I joined the Patricias in Winnipeg.
Mm-hmm.
That was A Company.
A Company. And you received your initial training there in Winnipeg?
Yes, I became what was known in those days as a trained soldier before the outbreak of war. Used to take roughly 2 years to become a trained soldier.
Was process training within the unit you learned by doing as you were doing it?
Yes. They had recruit squads.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, regardless of where you were in recruit training, they had a form of integrated training, which meant that when you went to camp every summer, you were posted to a platoon and you did field maneuvers and tactics along with more experienced soldiers than yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, one learned.
Did you find it to be an effective way to learn?
Extremely effective.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, many years later, when General Simmons was the Chief of General Staff, he was trying to get the same system in vogue, what they call integrated training, and I was given the task at one time to, I've forgotten whether completely alone or to assist in writing a General Staff instruction,
mm-hmm.
which was the basis, which was to implement integrated training within the forces. People didn't seem to quite comprehend it or get with it.
Mm-hmm.
And after his departure, it fell by the wayside. But in retrospect, they use it even today for the militia when they take militia people and attach them to the regular army and send them to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a very good system of training.
But I would imagine Simmons wanted to do it with the permanent forces.
That's right.
And that was on something of a larger scale.
Oh, much.
Like,
that's when we were roughly 100,000.
Mm-hmm. Before the army was...
reduced, yeah.
And cut. Slotted. Okay, we're 1938 or so?
1938 is when I joined the regular army, and I was with them till the outbreak of war.
Okay. Before we get to the outbreak of war, you're in Winnipeg this time, and you're there right up to the outbreak of war.
Correct.
Okay, what was the permanent force like in that period before the war? Was it a time of reform? Was it a time of stagnation?
I would not say it was a time of stagnation when I look back on it, because we had some very good people. The instructional cadre was there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we had some excellent people who weren't thinking of World War I. They knew British field service regulations were out. And I think if one goes back and studies them, you'll see that they were well on the way towards the doctrine that was evolved in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did not dig trenches. We dug slit trenches, and all the things that were common in World War II were part of our training, say, the summer of 1938 and early 39.
Had this still become official doctrine, or was this on the level of instructors teaching it to you?
It was, I would imagine, doctrine, because it was employed within all the tactical exercises.
Mm-hmm.
A lot depended on the individual officer, or especially the warrant officers. There was a good cadre of senior warrant officers, W1s, W2s, QMSI, when they used to have in those days instructors, who were extremely knowledgeable,
mm-hmm.
and professionally very competent, experts in weapons. Any weapon that was in the force, you couldn't beat them. that didn't necessarily mean that, although they were excellent, we found that a lot of them who were excellent instructors didn't pan out as good field soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and vice versa. Some of them who weren't terribly good peacetime soldiers were exceedingly competent and good in the field.
Mm-hmm. Well, because war throws a different wrench into the process, doesn't it?
Completely different requirement, especially when you've got a mass of men who are not basically militarily oriented.
Yeah, so the whole idea of discipline, I think, is that a civilian coming into the forces really can't be expected to grasp what one who is brought up within the system grasps.
No, and they weren't prepared to put up with it either,
mm-hmm.
especially the South Saskatchewan Regiment.
Great deal of individualism, I should think, men on the prairies.
Yes, I would say they were very independent-minded.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them had either come from the farms or bush or small communities. Physically robust,
mm-hmm.
used to hardship, didn't find soldiering difficult,
mm-hmm.
But wouldn't conform to the spit and polish and smartness and saluting routine unless there was some special reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I can recall an incident which exemplifies that. When the regiment was being presented with its colors by the king, I was at that time a liaison officer at 2nd Division Headquarters. I was given a day off to go down and watch the presentation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my God, they'd been trained by the guards instructors, and they were smart as any guardsman. And they had a saying at that time, if anything moved, it was saluted. And certainly the men, if they could even think you were an officer, their arms were waving in all directions. I saw the same battalion 2 weeks later in the field, and they were just as scruffy and noncommittal as ever.
Everything in its place.
But I certainly had my eyes open, because when I first joined them as a subaltern and went on the field exercises,
mm-hmm.
what was sort of a ragtag, undisciplined group around the barracks were exceedingly good in the field.
Mm-hmm. So the spit and polish really had nothing to do with efficiency in the field?
They had to be clean, but I mean, there's a difference between being clean and tidy and the perfection of spit and polish and smartness that was demanded in the regular army.
Do you think that your period as a rank did help you to see this, whereas people who become officers straight away tend not to see it from their perspective as much?
I think not in that respect, but what my reaction was that, having been another rank, one knew the effect of orders.
Mm-hmm.
And you, I think, were more aware of what the order meant. The individual than the man who never had to perform some of the tasks that you ordered him to do.
Mm-hmm.
It also gave you a better understanding of men,
mm-hmm.
having lived amongst them.
Yeah.
And I think you knew which way to play the game insofar as leadership is concerned. And using each man as an individual, let's put it that way.
Well,
he wasn't just an automat.
That's right. You had to learn how to manipulate people.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, where were we in? We're talking about the 38-39 period, weren't we? Yeah. Were you a private when the war broke out in 1939?
I was a private, trained private. I had just completed a course in rangefinding and 3-inch mortar.
Mm-hmm.
This was to be the reason I was kept in Canada.
As an instructor, then?
As an instructor.
And when the...
When the regiment went overseas in December 39, I was one amongst many who were sent to Calgary to Curry Barracks to form the nucleus of the training establishment.
Mm-hmm. And I guess being a lowly private, you really didn't have too much say in the matter.
Well, by that time, I had become a lowly sergeant.
Okay, well, as a lowly sergeant, you didn't have much to say about it, I guess.
No, as a matter of fact, we paraded in mass and requested to be reverted so we could join the regiment and go overseas. It was denied. Well, we said, that's all right. They'll still get with you somehow. And we were told that regardless of what we did, we were going as instructors to where we were supposed to go. And they put guards on the train to ensure we couldn't get aboard.
Mm-hmm.
So it ended up, once the regiment sailed, we said, well, we may as well get on with it. And we packed our bags and went to Calgary.
Okay, and what were your duties there?
I was an instructor in the early days. Before I became an instructor in the specialist company,
mm-hmm.
I was with one of the so-called rifle training companies, if you can use the word rifle, because it meant a basic training company.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did we train anywhere up to 100 men all day. But in the evenings, we used to instruct the other NCOs how to instruct from roughly 7:30 till 10:30 at night.
It's kind of a full day, isn't it?
It was a long day and a hard day. As well as that, we were expected to have our own work prepared for the following day. That's why I say it was no easy task in the early days of the war. Mm. And they had one policy which was a great irritant to all the regular army. We were told, because we were the nucleus, that for every one of the regular army who was going to be promoted, there would be at least 20 non-permanent men being promoted well over us. So you'd end up one day with a man on your guard as a private, the next day, or a week later, you'd find him as a sergeant major, and maybe a month later he'd be an officer.
Mm-hmm.
While we still were told to soldier on in the same old way.
I suppose they had to do this looking back at it in order to retain some degree of the system, didn't they?
They had to, because it was where the expertise was.
Yeah.
And they had to retain it long enough until they got enough of the, you might say, older and medical category people from the militia,
mm-hmm.
who then became the permanent staff.
Yeah. Yeah, this is what they did, didn't they? They sent a lot of militia units overseas and then replaced the elder officers and elder
That's
NCOs
right.
and brought them back. Yeah. Pretty an efficient system.
Some weren't allowed to go. Some who had belonged to the regiment, like for instance, let's take the Loyal Edmontons, who were too old to go overseas, were sent into the training centers.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the Sea Force, same thing with the Calgary Highlanders who were there.
Mm-hmm. How long were you in Calgary?
Oh my God. When did I go overseas? 1940, 41. I was in Calgary until about June of 41.
Okay, what has happened between that time? France had fallen. Oh, quite a bit has happened. Were you still a sergeant then in 1941?
I was a sergeant in 1940 I was a sergeant until January 1941, at which time I became a second lieutenant.
And how did that affect your life?
Well, that's an interesting little story. I was doing company sergeant major of the specialist company one morning when I was, the orderly said the major wanted to see me in his office.
Mm-hmm.
I reported in and he said, "Good morning, Mr. Edmondson." And I sort of, the mister sort of went over my head for a second.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "You are now commissioned and you are to report to the officers training me. Report to Major Hammy Roberts," I guess it was, of the Strathconus, who was running the officers' wing. Cocky Roberts, he was called. I reported to the officers' wing, and this chap who I had known first as a warrant officer class one was now a major. And under his little bushy eyebrows, he looked up at me and he said, "What blind bastard chose you as an officer?" The second thing he said was, "Get those goddamn Patricia flashes off. You're no longer a Patricia."
Mm-hmm.
His third instruction was, "Report to the quartermaster and draw your gear. Report back here at 1 o'clock. I reported back at 1 o'clock to say the quartermaster was short of gear and I couldn't gather a full kit. He said, "That's no problem, Mr. Edmondson. You're now in charge of the probe of platoon as an instructor, and there you will remain instructing until such times as you do your exams with the officer class and you'll graduate with them."
So instead of being a sergeant instructor, you're now an officer.
I was now a second lieutenant instructing, and by some miraculous means, I was supposed to qualify as a second lieutenant and pass the exams.
What were the exams like? Did you pass them right away?
I went through them with the graduating platoon of officers.
Mm-hmm.
I would say on all things, up to minor tactics, I knew more than they did.
Because
of my past experience.
Mm-hmm.
However, when it became more to the, you might say, the company battalion and the theory of war and the phases of war, like advance to contact, attack and defense and withdrawal, those were things of which I only had a sketchy knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Were a lot of the people in the officer platoon university graduates?
They were a mixed bag,
yeah.
Both from university and non-university.
Mm-hmm. How did you find them?
Excellent young officers.
Mm-hmm.
Nice people.
Mm-hmm. You said that you tore the flashes of the PPCLI off your shoulders. What did you put on to replace them?
South Saskatchewan.
So now you were an officer. Were you listed in the regimental depot at this time?
No, that was one of the oddities. I kept getting letters after a while from, I think it was Major Oster, who I knew from my hometown days, who was commanding the reinforcement company of the South Saskatchewan and Winnipeg, saying, please come here and come on staff, and I will make sure that you get overseas as soon as possible. To which I replied, I would like to go overseas directly. I do not wish to come on staff. And I was then sent as one of the few instructors to open the fourth Div school at Shallow, Manitoba. Mm-hmm. I'd only been there a week or two when I had embarkation orders. In other words, I was granted 72 hours leave to go home and to be prepared. I was to report to district headquarters to be prepared to proceed directly overseas. When I reported into the military district headquarters, the brigadier said, you're that young man who's caused us so goddamn much trouble. Get your ticket, get on the train, and get out of my command. I said, yes, sir. So, as I was still receiving letters when I arrived in the holding unit in England from Major Officer saying, please come to the staff. To which I replied, you'll be glad to know that I am now in England. End of correspondence.
Yes. Has the Major been writing to the your commanding officer?
I gathered that he had been trying to get me out of the district because I was in the wrong district to be a reinforcement officer to the South Saskatchewan Regiment.
Mm-hmm. And so the CO just eventually said, get out.
They arranged my departure direct overseas.
Where'd you land? Well, before I ask you that, what kind of ship did you travel on across?
I can't recall any of it. It was a big converted liner.
Mm-hmm.
I was then made the adjutant of miscellaneous details to some major whom I had never met. We had about 40 odds and sods,
mm-hmm.
mainly officers, that we had to marshal and make sure they had their billets and do boat drill and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then we landed somewhere in England, I guess around Bristol.
Mm-hmm. And you proceeded where? Were you given leave immediately? Or?
After, I went to the, I guess it was 3rd Canadian Infantry Holding Unit,
mm-hmm.
which had the reinforcement company and the holding company for the South Saskatchewan.
Did you say 3rd?
I think it was 3 CIHU.
Wasn't the South Saskatchewan 2nd Division?
It was, but this is holding unit.
Mm-hmm. But the holding unit was attached to the 3rd Division?
No. Mm-hmm. Holding unit was part of the reinforcement setup in England.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was down at Wickley Camp.
I was under the impression that each regiment had their own holding depot, or had this been changed at this time?
That is true, but it's a question of how it is organized.
Mm-hmm.
We had a South Saskatchewan regiment company, which belonged to the holding unit,
mm-hmm.
and it was under a group headquarters.
And this group headquarters is under 3rd Division?
No,
yeah.
It was under, I would think, Canadian military headquarters in London,
uh-huh.
as I understood it.
Mm-hmm.
Not under the divisions at all, because the divisions were an operational command.
Mm-hmm.
This was purely a training command.
Now you just mentioned 3rd Division, that threw me off slightly,
yeah.
but I see what you mean. Yeah.
They were numbered. I think there was 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, depending on what they were. There were artillery holding units, there were engineer holding units, that type of thing.
Mm-hmm. And you went there, and what happened after that?
Well, of course, we were granted leave. I think it was 72 hours or something like that when we first arrived.
Where'd you go?
I went up to Scarborough to meet an aunt whom I had never seen.
Mm-hmm.
It was most amusing. I tell the story at times. She gave the impression she was expecting some wild young man with feathers in his hair or a straw in it or something to come out of Western Canada. And she was a rather refined old lady who, when I phoned her, invited me to tea, but on a specific date and time.
Within the limits of your leave, I hope.
Yes, I was just able to see her on the same day that I had to catch the train back.
We had a nice little chat, I hope.
Oh, we chatted. She was very much like my father.
And when you got back from leave, you reported back to the
holding unit.
Uh-huh. And how long were you there?
I can't recall specifically. We were there a number of weeks, and we went to what they called a group refresher officers training course,
mm-hmm.
which went on for 3 or 4 weeks. And in those days, they had a system of attaching young officers or new reinforcement officers to the battalion.
Mm-hmm.
And depending on how well you did, you either stayed or you were returned, and you stayed returned until there was really a call for you.
Mm-hmm.
So I reported to the regiment and never left. That is, never left until I was sent on staff.
Okay, now, how did you find the regiment? Because you hadn't really seen it since you had been a part of it since before the war when it was a militia unit. How did it change?
Well, it's hard to say how it had changed. It's, I guess the question is how I had changed.
Mm-hmm.
I found it difficult coming from an instructional environment and regular force background
mm-hmm.
to suddenly come to a field battalion that was on coastal duty and to find that there was no cohesion. In other words, the company commander didn't direct the training. He simply said, this is your defensive area, get to know it, and draw up a training program for your own platoon.
Mm-hmm.
So drawing up a training program was no great problem. But trying to find out, you might say, the higher level things of war at that time was just not on.
Mm-hmm.
All you could find out was defense and how to patrol the beach at night.
So perhaps that's all they really wanted you to know at that point.
I would think so.
So at this point, it was 1941, and I think the threat of invasion passed, hadn't it?
Just passed, but they thought there could still be raids.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose if it did nothing else, it gave the people back in Britain a bit of a support.
That's right. To know that the Canadian division was on, the only fully equipped division was on defense on the south coast of England.
And it gave you guys something to do too, I suppose.
Oh, it kept us busy.
Whereabouts were you stationed?
At Seaford.
Seaford, where's that?
Oh, southeast England, west of Dover.
Mm-hmm. I know, and around Folkestone?
West of Folkestone.
Folkestone.
Yeah. West of Eastbourne. But east of Brighton.
Mm-hmm.
Brighton, New Haven, Seaford, Folkestone, Eastbourne, Dover.
That area down there.
Around there.
How wide a frontage did you have to patrol?
Oh, we had the, in my particular platoon, we had two things. We had a platoon defensive area on the left side of the main beach, which was on the old golf course.
Mm-hmm.
Why were there weren't more people up on the headlands, I'll never know. But when we did stand to, you had a duty platoon, and you stood guard, and you had sentries on duty. And as the platoon officer or duty officer, it was your task then to go from post to post, make sure everybody was alert, and keep an eye open.
Mm-hmm.
So it was rather interesting in one respect to do this at night under all weather conditions.
Mm-hmm. It made it very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What about morale of the troops? They've been there for quite some time, haven't they?
Oh, I would say morale at that time was still generally good.
Mm-hmm.
They were bored at times, but generally good.